This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. And today, what's leading the news is not a variant, but plans for the railways. Isabel, can you talk us through what the government's proposing and why there's been some mock?
Yes, so this is the formation of a new body called Great British Railways, which Transport Secretary Grant Shapps has announced is going to take over timetables, ticketing, prices and infrastructure. And we are going to lose all the different company brands. So everything's going to be under the same GBR logo, although confusingly, it only applies to England. So not that great, just English Railways. And it is also being mocked because it is initially, superficially, sounds a little bit like the Conservatives are stealing another, not just a Labour policy, but a Jeremy Corbyn policy by taking state control of the railways. But it's much more complicated than that. It's not a renationalisation of the railways because these private companies will continue to operate the different lines themselves, much in the same way, actually, as TfL is the umbrella body for different services which are run by private companies on different lines. But things will change. So the companies will only be paid if the trains are on time and clean. But on the flip side, the government, the companies, will bear far less risk if passenger numbers fall, which has obviously been something that they have struggled with over the past year because no one's been getting the train because everyone's been at home in lockdown. So there are various sort of political aspects to this and branding glitches as well, which make it interesting. But it's not a renationalisation, and neither is it something that is guaranteed to bring fares down. So you might ask, why bother?
James, Isabel touches on the fact that lots of people working from home over the past year are not using public transport. Is the Prime Minister of the belief that this is going to change, that actually the remote working is a temporary feature and therefore public transport is going to be needed for commuting? Or do you think that they think some of this is going to hang over?
Boris Johnson is one of those people who definitely thinks that, you know, once COVID is over, people will want to come back to the office, that city centres will be bustling and busy again, and, you know, you'll once more have kind of Waterloo and London Bridge and other commuter rail stations around the country disgorging kind of tens of thousands of passengers at rush hour. And I think there's an interesting point about pricing here, which is there are some people in government who think that you should use pricing to try and encourage a return to the office. So they say, well, look, if you basically make a flexible season ticket for people who want to come in 3 days a week, almost the same price as one for people who want to come in 5 days a week, that's going to boost the number of people coming back to work. The government today seems to be suggesting that the flexible season ticket will actually be kind of genuinely cheaper. It'd be far more like, if you're only coming in 3 days a week rather than five, you'll only be paying kind of 60% of the previous price. So that, I think, is interesting. I also think this kind of London Overground model is interesting because it's basically kind of, the idea is kind of guiding mind, but a private company carrying out providing the services. Because I think the guiding mind thing is interesting because of the Tory desire as part of levelling up to kind of reopen certain routes that might not be what a private rail operator would prioritise because they're not the most profitable routes.
Now, elsewhere, the Australia trade deal debate goes on, and ministers met today to talk this through. Isabel, it seems as though it is the free marketeers who are winning this one, and actually concerns and figures such as George Eustace and Michael Gove have not been heeded by the Prime Minister. Do you think we're going to see an Australia trade deal that would please Liz Truss?
Well, I suppose that would make sense given she's the one who's largely leading the negotiations. But apparently she left the room happier than George Eustace. So, as you say, it's the sort of the free marketeers, did you call them the little Tories?
I think little free marketeers and Waitrose protectionists were the phrase used, though whenever I do say this, not everyone is pleased.
So it's a triumph of what you, Katie, have called the little free marketeers over the Waitrose protectionists. And as we've previously discussed on this podcast, it's something that Red Wall MPs, who are very concerned about the price of food for their constituents, are very keen on. Now, the talks are obviously continuing, and there are some interesting dynamics with regard to the union, particularly Scotland, something that Ian Blackford raised at Prime Minister's Questions this week in his customary angry style. He described the Prime Minister's responses on the trade deal as being chilling and warned that many Scottish farmers would just go out of business if the deal was signed in the way that is being suggested at the moment.
James, when it comes to this deal in the union, do you think it does pose a threat? And because we've seen opposition figures talk about Wales and Scotland and farmers there, but it's not on such a huge scale, the deal, is it?
We have this is the first kind of wholly new trade deal the UK has done since Brexit. The UK-Japan deal had some things in it that the Japan-EU deal hadn't had in it, but this is the first wholly new one. And I think because it's the first trade deal for 40-odd years, we are all reading too much into it. I think both its opponents and its proponents are wrong when they suggest it's going to have a material effect on the price of food on British shelves. It's not. It's not because Australia makes up a tiny amount of beef exports into the UK. And even if it doubled or tripled or quadrupled or quintupled, it would still make up a very small amount of the beef sold in the UK. Also, it's worth remembering that the price of beef in Asia is roughly twice what it is here. So I think Australian farmers are probably going to remain focused on that. Let's imagine that there is a second Scottish independence referendum. I think the idea that there are large numbers of farmers who will be going to the ballot box with the Australia free trade deal as the primary thought in their mind is, I think, wrong, because I don't think its effect. I think we are all imagining that it is going to have a bigger, more dramatic impact than it actually is, because it's the first trade deal that has been done for 40 odd years. I think one thing which is true is that I think you see here the SNP government spent every day working out how best to advance the cause of independence, and I think you can bet your bottom dollar that they will attack every trade deal the UK government signs as being bad for Scotland and suggesting that Scotland's interests have been sold out. Now, I think this is a real interesting test of how much focus the UK government is going to put on the union, how good it is going to be at getting its message across, because there are lots of Scottish industries that will be beneficiaries of the trade deals that the UK signs. Just to take one quick example, Scotch whisky faces huge tariffs in lots of markets around the world. Reducing that would have a significant impact. Scottish cashmere products, similar problem. And so it's a really interesting question of whether the UK government has the patience and the focus and the determination to actually get its message across in Scotland. I mean, I think that, you know, because that's one of the things the UK government has been exceptionally bad at. You know, you look at the polling suggesting how many Scottish voters think that the furlough is actually a Scottish government scheme, not a UK government scheme. And so I think the question of whether they are able to communicate the benefits of these trade deals for Scotland, I think will tell us a lot about how good they actually are at working out how to speak to the Scottish media, how to get messages across to Scottish voters.
And finally, Isabel, the Indian variant has been dominating the news this week, but is the picture now starting to look brighter as more data comes in?
It is, and you heard it here first, because Katie, in your column in The Spectator this week, you had already written that ministers were very upbeat about this, and today we got the briefing confirming that from government scientists who've said that the Indian variant appears to be only 30% more transmissible than the Kent strain, which is good news because there were fears it would be more than 50%. And so this suggests that we are on for the unlocking day of 21st of June. But as you report in your column, there may be some modifications to that.
James, do you think you're going to get to go to Lords this year?
I'm getting more and more optimistic about hearing that the Lords hum this year in a relatively full house for the India Test match. So, because the data is very encouraging. Data out today suggests that after two jabs, Pfizer is 90% effective and Oxford AstraZeneca is 89% effective. Data out today suggests that in every age group above the age of 50, vaccine take-up is above 90%. And, you know, I think the UK will soon overtake Israel as the most vaccinated, you know, the major country that has vaccinated the largest percentage of its population, because while Israel was very quick, it's run into quite a lot of vaccine hesitancy in its population, whereas the UK really doesn't have the same problem. You know, there's been a lot of talk this week about vaccine hesitancy and how much of an issue that is. The polling indicates the UK is going to hit 90% of the UK public are prepared to take a vaccine. That is higher than any other country. So I think that's encouraging. Also, the hospital data out of Bolton remains encouraging. It does suggest that the vaccines have broken the link between hospitalisation and cases. So I think with COVID, you know, it is always best to be kind of pessimistic, but I think it is becoming quite hard not to be optimistic about June 21. I think what has happened is, I think that there was a lot of concern at the end of last week in government. Then I think there began, as the data was a bit better than expected, the transmissibility rate looks lower than the 50% that was initially feared. People began to thought that June 21st might be hit. And what you are beginning to hear from people sotto voce is, they might not hit June 21, but they might also hit June 21 with some of the social distancing restrictions going. So I think things are looking more hopeful at the moment. I think, you know, we're going to have to wait another week or 10 days before we can kind of speak with confidence and certainty about the data. But I think so far the news is encouraging, and I think the news on the efficacy of the vaccines after two doses is really encouraging, because that suggests that they are Oxford AstraZeneca performs in the real world even better than it does in the trials.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Isabel, and thank you for listening.